Good evening, everybody. It's Wednesday night, and we're getting started again on The Hidden Work by E.J. Gold. This is, we're remaining on chapter 12. And the chapter is entitled The Octave. And this is our fourth class on it. And we'll go actually one more class after that. There's a lot of material here, but it's actually material that we have to harvest because it's material that we've covered over the years on the different various books, but we've not put it into this context before. And it's a good context to put it into, and it's good work to focus on this way and this kind of material because it kind of creates a framework. For us to into which to put our experiences. Years and years ago, I went to a Christian Buddhist conference, Naropa Institute, and this is when Trungpa was there, and he had all these luminaries from both the Christian community and the Buddhist community giving talks, and David Stendhal-Ross was one of the speakers, and he was a monk that has became very well known as a writer and a speaker, and he was talking about the Christian mystical experience. And what he indicated was that a lot of these brilliant mystics, you know, like Suso and Ruiz Braillac, Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, Jacob Boehm, on and on and on, these great Christian mystics, they had their experiences within the church which gave them a format, okay? It gave them a format in which the experience could be discussed, understood, so on and so forth. That's partly what we're doing here too, is we're going through this material to impart, giving all of us the material we need to understand our work better. And in that context, we experimented last week with Aria sharing a specific event that she had, and I think she's on tonight as well. And I want to thank her for that. I don't know if she's on the phone. But a couple of other individuals have indicated that they are willing to share online too, and possibly on the phone this evening. So, as usual with this kind of a course and this kind of work that we're doing in a particular evening, it's dependent on the work that we put in. That then becomes a communal work, and in that communal work, there is a I don't know, I have the image in my mind of a cauldron, you know, being mixed together
like an alchemical process.
Like an alchemical process, yeah. That we are bringing forth of various elements to it. Last week, I believe, we talked about the components in a radio. Mm-hmm. And we talked about a diode and a resistor and a transistor, a capacitor, and these various things. All together, and only all together, do they create what's called a radio, and then does it work? We are like that. There are people here that are here, may or may not say anything all evening, but they're important to the particular work and invocation that we're working with. So what I want us to do is continue to focus this evening. This, we're getting into this part of the real meat of the chapter that's going to be very interesting, in my opinion. And along those lines, I want to do two things. First, I'd like Ivan to read the header of the chapter to orient ourselves once again. And then Ivan's going to read a poem that was contributed just a couple hours ago by someone. And we're going to have that read in a few minutes. So, Ivan, do you want to get us started then?
All right. Thank you. Chapter 12, octaves. Prayer absolute is in the form of an objective nine-stepped octave, which includes two intentional retardations introduced by internal activities of the awakened biological machine. The passage from one scale to another is what those steeped in scientific superstition call magic.
Okay, and then Paul, attributed after that.
Pleasant surprise. Bird chirps in crystalline colors. The moon shines bright and soft. The night is alive, clear blue, and my heart is cleansed in delight. And this is from Mark Roche, who sent this in.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
Thank you for, that was just perfect timing, I can't tell you. It was just right on. Okay, so let's get back into it then. So we're on page I'm not sure exactly what paragraph we left off on last week, Ivan. Did you notate that?
No, I didn't.
But I picked a place where I'd like to start again, and that's on page 125. I know we covered the top paragraph there because I remember the fine phrase of he remains a prisoner of familiarity. Mm-hmm. Pardon? He remains a prisoner of familiarity. But I'm going to go down a couple.
Ordinary man, actually.
Ordinary man.
Remains a prisoner of familiarity.
And we're going to see that in the next couple of paragraphs, too. So ordinary man. So a couple of paragraphs ahead of that, there are also two additional artificial octaves which are needed to pass from a lower octave to a higher. These additional octaves which form the missing notes X and Y are negative in nature, but they represent the negative force only when introduced to another octave. They are not negative in themselves, nor are they negative outside the sphere of organic life. So it's introduced as a term is being introduced here, this idea of negative. I'm wondering, Silverdale, is that something that you could speak on, like a negative force? You've mentioned it a number of times with regard to, like, when we speak about the triad of forces that come together.
Boy, David, I don't know if I have anything particular to offer that.
Okay. But
let me just say, David, I think it relates to, there is some discussion in this chapter about this idea that affirming, let's say the triad is affirming, denying, as in active and passive, and reconciling, which is a way of describing just about any kind of process or anything in the world, as I take it from Gurdjieff and Uspensky. But, you know, this paragraph here seems to be referring to this idea that the fact that something is affirming or denying can change in a different context. That something which here is denying, is negative, in this outside the organic sphere, this is saying that influence may be neutral or it may be affirming actually in another on another scale of
What we don't know is what role that particular note is to play in the symphony that we're creating as we go along here. Okay? We don't always know what that is. In relation to a particular cycle, it's a negative force. We don't really know what that means in regards to the energetic that's occurring. It's just in relation to that, it plays a negative force.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? This will be important in a couple of minutes. You're going to... Next paragraph. The ordinary octave is convex until the retardation, then after retardation it becomes concave and then convex again. This concavity represents the relaxation or weakness in the force propelling us through the inner octave. If we are to pass out of one octave into another, on whatever scale, whether to the higher or to the lower, this is what's important here is these are methodologies of transit. All right, I've spoken a lot about transit over the period of time here. These are methods of transit, and you catch the wave of transit in order to use it to move. Okay? Now, if you do not understand, this is, I've underlined, if you do not understand how to make the octave work voluntarily, you can be easily influenced by mechanical life because your activities automatically follow the inner octave of organic life. From this, there is no escape in the ordinary sense of the word. Do we get this? So, in order to utilize what is being presented here by E.J. Gold and earlier by the Rudgettian work, this is a way of working voluntarily with energy. And so we can provide voluntary moments that change things. If we're not going to do that, if we're not aware of it, we'll be swept into the ordinary life that we've been talking about here. Okay? Now, at this point, so mechanic, and so what I asked for the exercise is, can somebody observe that going on in them, in a sense? Can it observe just the ordinary flow of it as you get caught into it? But just the act of observation, it's delicate because if you look at it directly, it'll change it. So in a sense, you have to look at it with your peripheral vision, your peripheral attention, in a sense. And Jim, are you there?
Yes, David, I'm here.
And I'm wondering, Jim, if you would like to share your experience that you sent me an email about, and if that could get it, you could get us started on that. Would that be okay?
Okay, sure. Well, yeah, my problem as I saw it throughout the week was that when I was aware of the tensions occurring, it was almost always after the fact. So it was maybe some micro moments after I realized, there was someplace I was operating mechanistically, and there was a missed opportunity. And I was kind of despairing of actually catching one of these moments, except I did have something happen on Friday.
When you say, before you get into that, you say the word missed opportunities, is that the term you used?
Yeah, because I wanted to have the experience of actually catching it within the process so I could interrupt it.
And I want to emphasize that. I want to underscore what Jim is telling us here, is that one possibility is to watch yourself get caught in the mechanicality. In a sense, watch yourself get swept into that next moment of mechanicality. That's tricky. And that's what Jim is saying to us, and he's right. It is tricky because the ego and the sleep stay hidden. It stays hidden. And when you begin to observe what's happening, it's the beginning of the awakening of the machine, and it goes and hides. So I'll have an example later, but right now, Jim has a very unique example that he'll share with us now. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, so it does need a little background, and it's related to two work colleagues that I have and that I was going for coffee with. And several weeks ago, we were having coffee in the cafeteria, and these two people are sort of idealistically at opposite ends of the pole. One's very liberal, one's very conservative. And they got into a huge fight over something, I don't know what, which resulted in one of them storming out of the cafeteria and calling the other one several rude names. So in the intervening weeks, I've been going for coffee with each one of them singly at different times. And, you know, they both kind of vowed never to have coffee with each other again. So that's kind of the background. And then this Friday, basically what happened is I had an email from one of the guys asking me to go for coffee. So I just typed in yes. And then the moment I typed in yes, I'll go for coffee with you, I had a phone call from the second one asking me to go for coffee with him. And that was the moment. That was the moment when I was caught, because I kind of hesitated, and he picked up on something. He said, oh, you're busy. And he'd given me the opportunity to do what I'd normally do in this embarrassing situation, which is lie. And I didn't. I actually recognized it. And it felt like, I think I said in my email to David, it felt like being on the edge of an abyss. And so, anyway, I sort of leapt in and said, yeah, I'll go for coffee. So we now have the situation where I don't know what's going to happen. I'm totally at a loss in one sense, because I'm bringing both of these people together that don't want to be together. And I was, in a sense, just willing to accept that I didn't know what the outcome was going to be, whether it was going to be embarrassing, whatever. The moment I'd made the decision to kind of act, but act without knowing what was going to happen, that put me into a different space, in a sense. And sort of to cut that short, from then on, everything went very smoothly, in a sense. Both of these guys I was able to bring together, and we had a great coffee break, shared a lot of personal material. I even got to share some sort of work material with them, and it was a completely different space that we were able to participate in, all three of us. So it was an interesting experience.
So thank you, Jim. First of all, thanks for calling in and actually taking the time to write that up and sending it to me. Very good, very interesting stuff. So let's note a couple of things. One is, there was a moment the person number two calls in and says, do you want to go to coffee? And like myself, or maybe some of the others of us, Jim would normally just lie and say, oh, I'm busy or whatever, right? And that, of course, would be following the tact of the machine, is avoid conflict at all, even at the expense of integrity. But Jim, unfortunately for him at that moment, wasn't able to do that, couldn't lie for some reason. And then he said an interesting thing. Do you remember what you said next occurred, Jim?
Yeah, it felt like being at the edge of an abyss. I just didn't know what was going to happen. But I had my sword in my hand, and I was going to leap into it.
His sword in his hand. So what does he mean when he says he felt like he was on the edge of the abyss? You don't answer right now, Jim. We're going to try to see if we can get anybody else to speak. I don't know who's on the phone, but I know George is. But so what does it mean? I felt like I was on the edge of the abyss.
I have no idea.
Is that RC?
It is.
Hawk Lady? Hi, Hawk Lady.
Hello. Oh, Pianjo's got something.
Okay. Pianjo, what does Pianjo say?
He just wrote, outstanding experience, Jim. Thanks for sharing a moment of truth and a great story.
Aria, I don't know, I think she's on, but what is this? I'm interested in this specific moment called, I felt like I was on the edge of the abyss. That moment, what is that? What happened there? Can you read those?
I'm here. I can read them.
Oh, you're here. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. Let's see. There's two. Simon says, I think from the perspective of the machine was an abyss.
Okay.
We have Mark Roach that says, the abyss of stepping past the usual machine reaction and into the unknown, maybe. Simon says the edge was the change of octave.
Very good. Well put. Very good, Simon. And what was the introduction of the intentional force at that time? Jim, you can answer that one.
The introduction of the intentional force, that was the sense of doing something which I had no control over. I had no sense of control in the situation. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
You were willing, there was a willingness at that moment to be in this event of the unknown. He knew there was significant conflict there between these two individuals, because all he knew from his historical personality is they're going to be exactly the same like they were last time, you know, going at each other with picks and axes and knives. That's where it left off, but something circle said, let's give it a go. Okay? Any other comments on the what it means to be on the edge of the abyss?
No, just Jim H. saying the unknown.
It is the unknown. Partly what occurs there, and this is important to remember in terms of our sense of transit all the time, when we open ourselves up to more, we are, by definition, going from the known to the unknown. We're going from the known of the mechanical self and allowing ourselves to move into the unknown. And that's the, I don't know, it's like a taste of the void at that moment. It's just a momentary taste of the void, and in that taste of the void is, that's the heart of where chaos is. Guess what else is there? That's the home of creativity. It's the home of creativity. And I know Susan, well, I know Susan for sure, but I know Aria also has expressed a number of times to me that there are moments when she was different, therefore the other person was different. She was different, therefore the other person was different. So now, what role did Jim H. provide for those two individuals as well? Okay? Interesting, huh? We want to think that we're isolated people, we're just into ourselves, it's just us, it's just our deal, right? It isn't our deal. It is, we are working on behalf of others as well. And as soon as you enter into this space, and someone said to me the other day, a friend of mine from Tucson, she said to me, I guess as you get more advanced, you wind up being subject to more laws. Fewer laws. And I said, maybe that's true, but you are subject to those fewer laws with a higher degree of compliance. You are subject to more. So Jim, in his work, his diligent work that he's doing to awaken himself and work with others, it's clear that he's working diligently for others. But that means he's working on his machine to perfect it so it's a better tool for those others as well. And so at that moment, something happened. Right? Anything else?
No more comments.
Okay. The more specific, the smaller the event, the more specific we can be, the bigger the outcome is for us, the more we have to share with each other. The ones that are so small that we say, oh, it wasn't very important, those are the ones you grab. Okay? That's world. So where were we, Ivan?
Top of 126.
Okay, so don't mistake these two other octaves, which must be introduced, as some form of the affirming and denying force. It's a different principle. These are denying forces only when introduced to the original octave. The first octave, the octave within which we work, represents the affirming force. The additional artificially introduced notes, which are within themselves also octaves on a smaller scale, provide the denying force. Listen to this now. Without this denying force, no real passage from one scale to another, one scale of octave to another, would be possible. This passage from one scale to another is what those steeped in scientific superstition, they call that magic. But what do you think about this? Without this denying force, no real passage from one scale of octave to another would be possible. Do you actually believe that? So someone in the audience here is saying, it makes sense.
To me, this is an item for self-study, for observation and for self-study, because the part about passage from one scale to another, I'm very convinced is possible, that I've experienced that.
Yes.
And the responsibility, the implication of this, the necessity of having this denying force is something I would have to sort out by experiment, like observe.
Hey, Dave, maybe I could just throw in a couple of quick comments.
Dave, perfect.
Yeah, you know, it occurs to me, Gurdjieff emphasizes throughout Beelzebub's tales that there are two efforts required in order to self-perfect. The first one, conscious labor. We have to intentionally, voluntarily, consciously work toward self-perfecting. And the other is intentional suffering. And he says at one point, the best form of intentional suffering is to bear the displeasing manifestations of others toward ourselves. So just to kind of remain conscious in the middle of various circumstances. So as I'm reflecting on these octaves, look at our machine functions as, we'll say, the affirming octave. Now, I'm a little confused by this because I would often think that our personality is the denying octave, but within the context of this, okay, our personality in our organic body is the affirming force, and once we apply conscious labor, that is the desire to self-remember, to remember our essential self, that is to awaken our sleeping machine, that requires an effort on the part of our essential self, a denying force, to enter into the sleeping machine of the affirming force in order to create a new alchemical energy. That would be the conscious labor part, that is conscious labor on the part of the essential self to self-remember, to make an effort to awaken the organic machine, at which time we then begin to feel the second octave, which is intentional suffering, where like the absolute, we see the creation, but we don't think we can really do anything about it.
Right. So in relation to the, in a very general sense, in relation to the sleeping machine, in that context, in a certain way, the effort of the essential self's attention is a denying force. Mm-hmm. And there's a tension that's created there. And that was what was partly created with Jim, is that there was a tension, and he didn't deny the tension. That's the point. He allowed the tension to come in, and it helped him go to this other space, which then resulted in him tasting this thing called the edge of the abyss. You had a comment?
Dan. Dan's noticed that in a lot of ordinary things, you have to have resistance in order to accomplish anything. You can't hammer out a piece of metal unless you have something to hammer out. Like an anvil, or something to put it on that gives resistance. The light bulb to light. It's the resistance of the filament that causes it to glow, to light.
There's a couple comments.
He noticed that we're trying to step into a new octave. In order to create something new, you have to have the law of three put into it, put into effect. Affirming and denying and reconciling.
Which is it? Or else nothing will happen. Go, Susan, go ahead with those other comments, please.
Okay, so Hop Thady said it's the force of the denial which creates the energy to change octaves.
Yes.
And then
yes.
Mark is asking then, what does the force of denial refer to?
Okay, the other words in this chapter, EJ keeps bringing up these other concepts. One is retardation, which he just described in this passage we read tonight as concave and convex, which is a way of visualizing it. And the other one is a shock.
Yeah.
You know, it's do-re-mi shock, or do-re-mi retardation.
Yeah.
You know, and And then there's that language about propelling it through the, you know, through the interoctive. It's like going all the way up to this end of this octave, and then to the upscale, you know, to the other octave.
Well, here's the next paragraph.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the next paragraph. It is possible to borrow from another octave, which we call the reconciling force, which is not an original force existing independently, but a force which results from the combination of at least two other forces and makes their interpenetration possible, even though under ordinary conditions their combination would not be possible. Then he goes on to say, it is not necessary to know every little detail of a thing in order to actually use it. Contrary to what is usually taught in the so-called the universities. And then he says, one must be able to ask a real question. We're not going to let that go, but I'm going to read on, okay? For one thing, having a real question means the correct choice of subject matter. Of course, the subject of the question must be something necessary to your work, not just your work in general, but your work at this very moment. A real question is something which you must examine immediately without delay, because your very life, at least your work life, depends upon it. It is for some reason assumed, it has for some reason assumed the importance of your very survival in the work life. Now, at that point, what I'd like to do is, Hawk Lady, can you share what you wrote up? I think it might be a good time to take a shot at that.
Okay. So my example is that I went to a meditation class, and I got there just before the meditation actually started, and everybody was already sitting. And so I quickly found a seat and sat down. And within a few seconds, I realized that I was in the wrong place. The energies weren't flowing right, and I knew where I was supposed to sit. But the teacher was talking, so I felt awkward about changing my seat. And so it was a little casual environment, but it was still odd for me to change my seat. I went and I got a glass of water, thinking on my way back I could go sit down on the ground maybe, squeeze myself in between people, but it didn't feel right, so I went back to my original seat. And I decided that I was just going to let the teacher deal with it. Maybe the teacher knew what to do. It's not my class. I should mind my own business. And all of these logical thoughts were going through my mind. But I was going to let it go. Although it felt very, very uncomfortable not to take charge and say something and create something that would cause me to have the opportunity to go sit where I was supposed to sit. But I sat and I didn't say anything and I didn't do anything. And a lady got up to go to use the restroom, and that was my seat. And I took it and I got up as well, but I still didn't want to interfere. So I got up, I stood outside the circle, and I just waited. And then the lady went and actually sat in where I was sitting because her friends were next on my right and my left. When she took my seat, then I took her seat. That's it.
What did you observe at that moment? How did it feel?
Actually, it felt awesome. It was just wonderful that everything worked out without me having to take charge and take control or talk about it, and not allowing my ego to come forth. It really felt wonderful, just allowing things to happen the way they were supposed to.
But normally you would want to control the situation. You would like to be in charge and just say, I'm going to sit there, you sit here, now it's the way it's supposed to be.
Yes.
But that wasn't available to you, was it? Because it wasn't your class, for one. You were just attending it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So what happened? The comments, anybody?
Well, I'll tell you, I can't help but be impressed by how conscious Hawk Lady was of herself and her circumstances, and holding the tension of the whole environment, both within herself and the mechanics of the room and the history of the meetings, and then how perfectly it all resolved itself by leaving her seat, so that the other woman, who probably felt exactly what she was feeling, finally got to sit with her friends, because Arcee wasn't in the way, in which case Arcee was actually tuned into that higher octave of harmony within the group.
So what did Hawk Lady do? That's precisely, really a great description. There was a lot of tension there, wasn't there?
Within me.
You had tension.
Yes.
But you stayed with it. You just
you
watched.
You had tension. Yeah. And at first, I want to point out, at first what you did is you just went with it. Oh, well, I'll just sit here. But you weren't happy with it. I'll just sit here. It's no big deal. But you stayed with the tension, you didn't leave it, and then what happened? Comment, Susan?
Well, my comment would be, I wonder if the other woman felt the tension as well.
She may have felt it. Was she conscious of it like Hawk Lady was? That part we don't know. I would venture to guess that the answer is probably yes.
And then there's quite a few comments, not specific to this, though.
Go ahead, though, with some of the comments.
Okay, so Simon says, these are the nuances of self-observance and its smaller grade graduations, vigilance.
Yep.
Having a that's a computer moment, sorry. I like Winnipeg 9 says that in the essence of the man on the cross, less free above, more free in the higher octave.
Less free below?
Less free below, more free in the higher octave.
Yeah.
Jim says, like art is reformed from other materials, the marble is destroyed to create the sculpture.
Susan?
Yes?
I think you need to move your cursor down on the chat bar. That bar on the right-hand side.
Okay. Okay, we have from Mark Roach, says it seems like what happened is she respected the flow of the moment, and that very respect opened up the seat exchange.
Okay, good.
And then Piangio said active non-involvement, a new kind of trust in a situation she could not control.
Okay. A new kind of trust. All right. Did that remind us a little bit of sitting on the edge of the abyss? Okay. Remind us a little bit about that. Go ahead.
Jim H. said the tension was held and not dissipated.
Good.
And that's what I have for now.
So let's look at a couple of things here. One is that both individuals were dealing with a tension, and rather than dissipate it in a, you know, in a certain way, they they held the tension. They held the tension. The thing that, the reason I wanted both of them to share was because I found it remarkable that in a certain way, Jim's experience opened up a space for these two other individuals to come together. Now, that to me is part of the magic that occurred there. That's part of the magic that occurred because he was in a different space. He had up-octaved, in a sense, I'm sure that's wrong in English, but by that. And the same thing with Hawk Lady. Is she sat with a tension. And then, interestingly enough, with great courtesy, when she just got up, she didn't force her way into anything. She just got up and stayed with the tension. That the other person then somehow got up also, and then somehow just sat down in that seat that had already been occupied. Isn't that curious? What's the last line of the header again, Ivan?
Passage from one scale to another is what those steeped in scientific superstition call magic.
So part of what we're dealing with here is this idea of a real question, and its fundamental base is something called necessity. For RC, for Hawk Lady, it was important for her that at that moment, it was more important for her to be in tune with the energetic of the space than the social compliance, in a sense. That was like a sense of necessity that she had there. Mm-hmm. The sense of necessity was very important to her. It was driving her. That in itself created the tension. Okay? Necessity is linked to the concept of what is a real question. Do you have a real question? Do you have a real question that you can bring forth? At the same time, if go ahead.
Well, I hate to interrupt your flow. Hawk Lady said, I must say one more thing. It was her friends who called her to sit in between them.
Okay.
Her friends called her.
I don't get it.
Just saying the universe took care of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the universe took care of it. But it took care of it. I'm saying that the element that was imposed that allowed it to be taken care of was her working with this tension. The necessity she had of having a proper energetic is what allowed the, quote-unquote, the universe to take care of it. If she was sloppy in her attention, if Hawk Lady was sloppy in her attention, that tension would not have been present and the universe would have nowhere to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm putting burden on the individuals here, Susan. I'm putting burden back on Jim and Hawk Lady. It's because of their effort that something occurred.
And actually, Jim says he felt confident and indifferent to the outcome once he left.
Yeah. And I love that. He was confident yet indifferent. I'm going to read on a couple of paragraphs, okay? For it says, at the same time, if your life really depended upon fixating your attention on this real question, it would automatically produce the necessity to continue asking the question until it was answered, which may require years or centuries for clarification, and even then, nothing is final. I'm going to skip ahead, even though we talked about that already. The sly way, the cunning way, is to understand not from below, one fact at a time, but to increase necessity. The next two paragraphs are brilliant. Increase necessity, which is to say to be given everything necessary in accordance with the obligation which you have accepted as your part of the work, but only when one is actually working for the real place in the work is it possible to understand these ideas, because the ideas are understood only by experience. We may have become curious about these ideas, but until we agree to accept a greater obligation than the necessities given to us by organic life, we have no necessity for the understanding of ideas which apply only to a higher set of laws than those under which we ordinarily live. If, on the other hand, we accept a greater obligation, an obligation toward the absolute, which alone produces a real work necessity. Now listen to this. Only then can we begin to understand something of these ideas. This is a form of, for all of the philosophers in the group, this is a concept of epistemology that I have never seen expressed. How do we learn something? And the concept that's being expressed is we learn because of the force of the necessity we have for that learning. Very different. And Dan is telling us that it's also expressed in Sufi literature, which of course EJ has a deep background in as well. So it's this concept of necessity is what brings the understanding. Idle curiosity is nothing. It's only by people like Hawk Lady and Jim H. who have put in the time to study a particular event it's because of their necessity at the time that it allowed them to understand. And I guarantee you, for both of those individuals, they put themselves on the line in this class, for both of those individuals, at this point, they have more. They will take something back to their life tomorrow that wasn't there before. Okay? Go ahead on the comments, Susan.
Okay, Simon says it is the resistance to act in a different way as you always do. You cross it, I think he means the abyss, when you take an unusual action to the ones that you always do.
Okay.
Jim H. says, the abyss for me is like a void-like feeling of not knowing what will happen.
That's exactly what it is. That's its nature. Its nature is the nature of chaos. Chaos is uncertainty by definition. And it's almost impossible to allow ourselves to be driven into the abyss, because we are what? Prisoners of familiarity. We are prisoners of familiarity. We seek our way back there. That's the great effort that, you know, that Silverdale was telling us about this. That's the great battle between these two great forces within us. Go ahead, Susan.
Well, I just, what we're reading about the, you have to experience before you can know.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's what we're doing. I know for me, whenever I have to talk in this class even, by the necessity of having to be there, I experience more than just sitting back. It's like all of a sudden it's necessary.
There's more, you're putting more attention into that space than you would normally do because of the because of the requirements of you accepting the post of doing this little job, right?
Right.
You put yourself in and say, yeah, I'll do it.
And then,
are there any other?
Let's see. Jim H. says, the machine cannot know, going against machine habit and experience. Lost Horizon says, prisoners of familiarity. What a great expression.
Yes. Who said that?
Lost Horizon.
Yeah, okay. That's from our chapter here.
Where is he?
He's lost.
And then from Pianjo, we have, when I have an experience of standing next to the abyss, I don't know what to do or say. There's nothing for my ego to do or say.
You're right. The ego isn't there at that time. That's the whole point. There's a whole other functioning. The essential self has come to town at that moment. You are in a new region now. Okay.
Yeah, there is these personal examples that we were given tonight. They are very interesting in that there is this element of the flow that comes from changing octaves or getting past the interval or something. In both stories, there's this suggestion of a new flow of the unexpected or the unforeseeable, let's say, happening and so on. And that's what I think here, you know, this is this idea that in the paragraph that David just read is, to me, it is about this kind of flow. I know that I've seen this or known this to happen, that if I can put myself in a position of necessity for the work, say in a study circle, in any kind of situation where I'm presenting that I need to have fluency, I need to have the ideas to be presented to other people, there's actually a flow that happens. It just comes, this kind of channeling, or this flow can come through you. So it happens. It's not something that you study for, that you plan for, but it's by arranging those other elements, just like in these examples here. By reaching this, putting yourself in this spot where there's tension, you know, where you're on the spot, and then again, not responding to that mechanically.
Yeah,
taking that.
Hudos is, I don't think is on. They're quite engaged.
Oh yeah, touring or something.
Well, in other ways too, but they're quite engaged. But musically, I was listening to the series called Jazz by Ken Burns,
mm-hmm.
and Wynton Marsalis was speaking, and he says, there's this tension between the players,
mm-hmm.
and they never discount the tension, but they enter into communication to resolve the tension.
Mm-hmm.
So another, there are no more comments. I wanted to share something because there's another form of the exercise that I was hoping to hear from some individuals, but I'll share one that that happened with me. So right now I'm in the middle of, I'm a tax accountant, I'm a CPA, right? And I'm in the middle of all these tax preparations. I've got 21 more to conclude by the 15th, which happens to be Monday. And so I'm very, very busy. So a couple of days ago, yesterday, I had to take a break. So I took a break and went out of the house and took a walk around the town, went to the post office, came back, and then I went to the local market. And I entered into the market, and I realized that I deserve a treat. Okay? I've been working hard, right? I've been working hard, and I deserve a treat.
So you say, yeah, right.
And so I'm sitting there, and I just went with this. I went with this feeling of I deserve a treat. And I marched around the store looking for the appropriate treat. And I was laughing out loud in the store because it was just moving me along.
Oh, right.
Until I found... And what I
like
I,
a magnet, no doubt.
Well, I was just like a I was just running from aisle to aisle looking for the right treat. So finally, I was standing. I'm standing in front of the donut case.
All right, that's it.
And. I mean, you know, I need another donut. Like, I guess it's not a donut, it's just called a spare tire, right?
Okay.
And I'm thinking about that. The logical mind keeps coming up and saying, you know, this food's not good, da, 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 da. But I just kept going with the I deserve a treat. And so I bought a donut. I have yet to eat it. This is 2 days ago, but it's sitting there in its little shrine on my kitchen table. But it was hilarious to watch myself being led around by this mechanic. It was just amazing.
Dave, I want you to eat that donut on the 16th.
On the 16th?
Yeah, really, you could save it, save it for after the deadline.
Hmm. On the 16th, I'll eat the donut. So, there was a...
That could be a retardation right there, George.
It would be, yeah. I'll lie down on the ground.
What is it?
Jim H. wants to know if we have a Tim Hortons. That's a, is that a donut? That's a donut shop up in Canada, I think. There's millions of them just... They're just parading around, waiting to be. So, anyway, that's the opposite, in a certain way, of the two stories that Jim and Talk Lady shared with us. And the key point in that energetic is to watch the concept of the necessity. Okay? So if you can determine the necessity that drives you to allow that tension to hang in there until you can move up to the higher octave.
Yeah, there's a waiting and watching element, isn't there?
And that's what it says in one of them, is sometimes you have to wait in a lower octave, knowing that you're waiting for that right moment. And we can understand how that works in each one of us, but we have to do the work. And I appreciate very much last week that Aria, what she had to share with us, and then this week with Jim H. calling in and with Hawk Lady. So I appreciate that work a great deal. And we'll actually finish this chapter next week. There's actually 3 pages, so I'm not 100% sure, 4 pages. But we'll see. We might get through it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to miss next week.
So Ivan won't be here next week, and we'll see if MA will sit in. But anyway, thank you. So that's it. Unless there are other questions. Are there other questions, Susan?
Can I read that poem again?
Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah,
Ivan has an idea.
There's lots of talk about donuts.
There's a whole donut conversation going on, huh?
So I think we could go with the poem.
Somebody say, watch the donut, not the hole.
You're taking it to a whole new level, right? So, now, check this out. We've gone through this transition with a number of individuals sharing and reading those 2 paragraphs. At the beginning of the class, we read a poem, right?
From Mark Roach.
And we're going to read it again. Go ahead, Ed.
Pleasant surprise. A bird chirps in crystalline colors. The moon shines bright and soft. The night is alive, clear blue, and my heart is cleansed in delight.
There's a lot more meaning now, doesn't it? Thank you, everybody, for coming this evening. We'll see you next Wednesday as we continue our work with the hidden work. Thank you. Good night, Ivan.
Thanks, David and Ivan.